Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I want to start off by thanking my my friends and supporters for their contributions. It's been heartwarming, to say the very least. And not even so much as a financial contribution, but the very fact that I have people who are willing to sacrifice. In this day and age, it really is, it's a tremendous boost to my persona these days. It remains a struggle, but knowing that I have a dedicated a base of fans and supporters is even more important than the money itself. So I thank you very much. Today, I have no choice. Today being my 45th birthday, by the way. I was born October 18th, 1971. I have no choice but to talk about the war that's been declared on Russia by the U.S., both de facto and de jure. Now, I've written, you can go back to my old website, the Wayback Machine, and see where I've said, you know, de facto war had been declared on Russia many, many years ago. Pretty much as soon as Putin broke from the oligarchs who financed his first campaign. But the level of viciousness, of vitriol, the lurid details of these threats, nothing like this ever existed during the Cold War. As I've written about on my website, rusjournal.org, and published elsewhere, the West was heavily invested in the Soviet Union. The Cold War is a bit of a myth, in the sense that you can't have a war where two countries are, you know, one country has been practically built by another one. You can't have this trade between Soviet Union and the U.S. and claim there's a war. But there was always a drive for peace, for arms reduction, for mutual understanding when it was a socialist state. Only when Putin has, you know, blatantly declared himself a nationalist, only now do you have threats to annihilate the country. Never at any time in American history has a disastrous war been so close. Hillary Clinton has made it very, very clear. Her threats against both Iran and Russia have been blatant and forward. The entire Republican Party, much of the Democratic Party, that any war against Russia is futile and will lead to just heaps and heaps of body bags. But the question is, why? I mean, at least we could say, you know, during the Cold War, what little battles there were between the West and the East, you could say that this is a totalitarian system that needed to be stopped. But you can't say that here. You're at a point now where you can believe nothing you hear in the corporate media in the West. You can believe nothing you hear, nothing you read. I mean, partially because of Johnson's Law, there isn't the specialization, but there's also because of this state of war. And journalists are going to be watched very carefully, so what they can say and what they can't say. Some of you may have seen John Kirby's ill-fated press conference last month, where a Russian reporter, a female reporter, had asked him to give evidence that Russia has done anything wrong in the international arena, let alone something so bad that it required a massive war. And his answer really was, it was really hard to watch. He stuttered for a while. He wasn't expected to actually be asked a substantial question. And he said, well, we've had media reports to the effect that Russia has deliberately attacked Syrian civilian infrastructure. Now, apart from the fact that Russia, what possible reason or interest would Russia have for doing this? Attacking a hospital, why would they, why? The first question anyone should ask when policy has been, is, you know, someone gets accused of this, is what is their motive? Why would they do that? And of course, he had none. There is no motive. It never happened. He claimed that actually he heard it from the media. But the media is what's driving State Department policy. But then he said he's heard intelligence briefings to that effect. No details, of course. And this has come up again and again. This hospital that was attacked doesn't exist. It was another story. It was very hard to watch, and it was very painful, not just because this guy was rightfully humiliated, but because this is what John McCain and Obama and Hillary Clinton and almost everybody with power in this country wants to send millions to their deaths over. No one has any idea why there is this vicious attack. I mean, the attacks on Russia are pretty much constant in the English-speaking world. But over the last 5 years, they've gotten to the point of bloodthirsty viciousness. It never existed during the Cold War, the so-called Cold War. The Soviet system had nothing to do with Russia. It was not Russian. It was Judaic. Soviet patriotism had nothing to do with Russian nationalism. Russian culture is strictly Orthodox. So Russian culture was banned and persecuted. The point being, regardless of how bad the Soviet system got, there was never this blood-curdling attack on it. And my question is, why isn't there mass panic in America, where you have blatant, we're going to destroy you rhetoric coming from politicians and military men? But the facts are this, first of all, and I think most of you know this, but any war with Russia automatically involves China, because the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is also a defense pact, like NATO. So any attack on Russia, it would be an attack on China. The U.S. couldn't defeat Russia, even just the two powers, let alone adding China into the mix. China would never, even if there weren't a defense pact, China would never tolerate an attack on Russia. It would be not in its interest at all. And especially on these ridiculous, flimsy public grounds. So my view is that there has to be a false flag. Eventually there has to be a false flag where a bunch of Americans are killed by Putin's agents, you know. And again, the question, whenever any of these things come up, you ask yourself, what is the motive of the actor here? The Ukrainian journalist who died of radiation poisoning. You know, it was terrible to see him die that way. But there is no question that Putin would never do that, because it would automatically entail him being on television every night, especially in Britain, and have Putin's name be constantly attached to it. He'd be immediately blamed for it. That would destroy his reputation. Why would he do such a thing? And why would he care, with popularity ratings that never go below 80%, what some hack journalist says about him? The press and the media in Putin's Russia is far freer than it is in America. There's far more companies that own the capital, that produce papers and magazines. There's a greater diversity of opinions. And even in corporations that the state has a certain percentage of the stock, you can find plenty of anti-Putin material. Anti-Putin material is everywhere in Russia. Even in state-owned firms, you have to even be careful there. State-owned doesn't mean state control, and usually it just means that the government owns a certain percentage of the stock that guarantees an agent, on the board of directors. But it's pretty rare that has anything to do with policy. Overwhelmingly, Russians support Putin. Unlike the U.S., the Russians are prepared for war. Unlike the U.S., the Russians have something to fight for. The war with Russia and China would be a disaster at so many levels. I don't have the time to get into it. Most of America's allies would dissipate. France would not be involved in this. Germany would not be involved in this. Turkey has already said it won't be involved in this. Greece certainly won't be. The U.S. can only count on Japan and Great Britain as its allies. And once the body bags start coming home in huge numbers, they're going to ask themselves, why are we fighting this war? And no one's going to be able to answer them. No one has any idea. There are three provocations that you'll find in the press, and these are always very vague. The first is that there is this alleged invasion of the Baltic states. Again, no one knows why this is going to happen, what motive, what reason it would cause Putin to do this. Number two, this alleged invasion of Ukraine, which is non-existent, it's a myth. It was invented by the Ukrainian military to cover over its own failures and humiliation. There's been no pictures of Russian soldiers there in any great numbers, no POWs, nothing. If Russia was involved in eastern Ukraine, they would have conquered the country, you know, immediately. They do have private contractors there, like the U.S. does. They do have volunteers there. That's for sure. But most of the country speaks Russian. Russia has every reason to be involved there. America has no reason to be involved there. And of course, last is the Syrian concern. Now, if you go back to the Orthodox nationalists from, I believe it was 2010, I did a full show on Syria and Assad, and I predicted the fact that the regime would try to dethrone him for a whole bunch of reasons. This is very close to our topic because Assad was creating a first world state, a first world economy based on a social nationalist model, which is a Ba'ath Party model. Just like in Russia, Syria was a multi-party democracy. You know, the Ba'ath Party, the social nationalists, the communists, liberals of different types, Islamic parties run for office there. Far more parties, far more means of expression politically in Russia and Syria than there ever is in America. And the civic debate and civic discussion and the platforms from which you can have that are far greater in both those countries than in America. The U.S. is a disaster in that respect, where three families control the entire media output. Even as a young man, I remember, you know, these people are using the same exact phrases to describe something. But when the regime wants something done, you'll see every media outlet demanding it. You will see both parties demanding it. As I've said to you many times, I define the word regime, I use this quite a bit, with a capital R, I define it as this informal coalition of public sector, private sector, elites, the world over, mostly headquartered in the U.S. though, that seek the destruction of all national borders for the sake of lowering transaction costs, to create this mixed, mongrelized, culturalist planet, controlled by media and media images. That's what the regime is. It's not formal. There's not a body. There's not a Congress. I mean, Bilderberg, I guess, is as far as close you can get to that. But it's not formal. These are informal structures and networks. You can't separate the state governments from the private sector. Anywhere. The private sector is too powerful. Governments, you know, don't do anything unless the corporate elites, and I'm talking about the West here, unless the corporate elites say to do it. Everything that's done in America is done at the behest of corporate capital, especially since most government services are privatized regardless. So we can't talk with the governments, let alone Obama. Obama doesn't know anything about foreign policy. He's completely ignorant. He's had nothing to do with these decisions. These are being made by career bureaucrats. The Zionist movement, which is always deep into the State Department, and oil firms, you know, corporate capital. Those are the people who make these decisions. Obama doesn't know anything. He didn't claim to know anything. He came into office thinking in domestic terms only. And it irritates me when I see people refer to the oppression of the U.S. government like that's a simple concept. No, corporate capital is far more to blame. And Obama has no idea what's going on. He's not supposed to have any idea what's going on. He can't keep control over his cabinet, let alone have an independent foreign policy. The job of the president is nothing more than to execute the will of Congress in a few very specific areas. And that really is to be delegated to members of the cabinet, meaning that the president really is the head of the cabinet primarily. He's not a leader. He is not a ruler. That is not the purpose of the American presidency. So, you know, referring to Obama or the U.S. government is completely absurd. They're not the actors here. The regime functions with different interests, throw their weight around in different areas. When it comes to Russia, energy is a huge part of it. But I can't think of any time, maybe some of the more extreme abolitionists before the Civil War, where this blood-curdling hatred for another group of people has been deliberately whipped up by the state to the point of insanity. Go out on the street and ask the first person you meet why this is worth a massive war. And especially when you have Hillary Clinton, who is promising it. This is something she will do, and her threats have increased. Remember, Hillary's campaign is not directed to American citizens. It's directed to elites only. That's why she doesn't have many rallies. Her campaign is directed to the elites. Fix it for me, and I'll take care of you. She has no intent or interest in winning the popular vote. Right now, her popularity is something like between 12 and 15%. Trump would completely destroy her. We're coming down to the wire here. Something has to happen. You know, the regime is not going to let this go through. But the big question remains, what is worth the mass slaughter of people, Russians, Chinese, Americans, especially when you consider that the U.S. cannot win the war? And the reasons are fairly simple. The U.S. doesn't have the manpower. The U.S. is a very unpopular empire. Overseas, it is completely overstretched. The U.S. doesn't have the allies, the support. The U.S. certainly doesn't have the popular will behind it. The U.S., most importantly, doesn't have the money to sustain anything. The U.S. is so deeply in debt, at least in part, to China, that they couldn't finance a campaign. Certainly not a war of attrition, especially since that there's no good reason for it. So a false flag, and if this is actually going to go forward, a false flag seems to be a necessity from the point of view of the system. And the U.S. simply can't win. I think I've mentioned this before, that the morale in the U.S. military is very, very low. These guys, I've never had a high opinion of military men in America. And my father was a Korean vet, Purple Heart with three clusters and a Silver Star. But I've modern, you know, military men today, especially officers, are spoiled rotten. They're overpaid, swaggering, and they're nothing more than mercenaries for the Zionist system. They're just bullies, very rarely having to deal with an enemy that can actually shoot back. Attacking a target from the air that doesn't know it's coming under attack is cowardly. Attacks on or countries without substantial air defense systems is cowardly. You're fighting an enemy that can't fight back, and you're killing people in the process. This General Milley, and some of you have heard this windbag, General Mark Milley came out and said that if you threaten the American way of life, we're going to destroy you, and we're going to beat you worse than we ever did before. Now, I don't recall a time where the Russians and Americans fought it out on the battlefield. But that's very odd. Now Milley, as most generals, he has combat experience. I believe he was actually on the front line. It's extremely rare. Now, I grew up in a military household. It's extremely rare that those with combat experience act with that kind of bravado, especially since there's no threat to the U.S. My father always used to say that the way to spot a phony, and it was very common that men tried to pass themselves off as war heroes all the time, especially in his day. At the minute they start talking about their combat experience to just anybody, the minute they start spouting off and glorifying it, you know they're fake. Because people who kill people in combat don't just yak about it to the first person they meet. They're phony. That's not how it works. That's not what that kind of experience does. And you certainly don't brag about it. It's not something to be proud of. It's a necessity. Now, and he actually exposed, he lost his left hand and his left ribcage, parts of his left ribcage, to a Chinese mortar in Korea. He was a little sensitive to the issue. These guys, very common, men trying to pass themselves off as military guys. And they didn't know any of the acronyms. They didn't know any of the statements. They were ridiculous. But Milley really bothered me because he's out there saying, we're going to destroy you. We're going to kill you. We're going to whip you. And that's not, it's a General Patton kind of thing. It's not common. So it seems to be something that he's being told the same, a script that's been written for him. When military men are usually the last to endorse the military option. That's for civilian politicians. Civilian politicians love war. So now we get to the question. Why this massive assault verbally on Russia? I've made the answer to this question really the cornerstone of my professional life. I've been following Putin's career since he was working in Mayor Sobchak's office in Moscow. I had predicted early on that he was going to become powerful and challenge the West. I thought he would do it with General Lebed, but that didn't work out. The simple fact is, with Putin, the fundamental idea, the bottom line, Putin inherited a fourth world backwater, a country that was quite literally disappearing, and turned it around and gave people the confidence necessary to rebuild, and now it's the sixth largest economy in the world and a major military power. And he does this in 5-7 years. There's very few people in history that you can say have done anything like that. I think I've mentioned some of this before recently. I think I mentioned even Hitler is one example. General Park in Korea is another one. But what he did is absolutely astounding. How he did it is part of why the U.S. is so violent. When I say the U.S., I'm referring to elites, the regime, really. I should just say the regime, using soldiers in this as their instruments. Early on, he stopped privatization just like Lukashenko in Belarus. He kicked out the Western bankers, the IMF, the World Bank. He threw out their playbook. And just like in Belarus, it was successful. I've been writing recently on China. And in the Council on Foreign Relations, this official document that's the central to the State Department's policy towards China, one of the big issues that they have is that China should not be allowed to undermine American ideological supremacy. Casting doubt on the Washington consensus is actually a big deal. Now, we usually focus on, nuts and bolts, dollars and cents, pipelines and trade and things like that, and that's very important. But don't count out the ideological side to this. That's extremely important, and it's very easy to overlook. Ideology is extremely important. Casting doubt on the Washington consensus, especially if this is spread over the world and there's a solid intellectual alternative to it, this is a nightmare. Americans, up until very recently, have not had any idea there's either collectivism or individualism. There's either capitalism or socialism in the Marxist, in the Soviet sense. And they think those are the only two choices you have. And most people aren't able to read through the political theory in the modern era of the various syndicalist movements and anarchist ideas that provide many different kinds of alternatives. There's many alternatives, but they're so foreign to the American mind. I've always been very sympathetic to Hegel and the syndicalist idea, which in his world is really the upper house of his parliament. Based on guild membership as being absolutely essential. Democracy at that level will not be tolerated in the West because it is a financial oligarchy. Now, to cast doubt on a Washington liberal consensus, and I say liberal in all senses of the word, in the lifestyle sense, in the economic sense, political sense, that's what these swaggering the soldiers and airmen are imposing on the world. They're nothing more than mercenaries. They're not to be admired. They're not heroes. They're overpaid. Right now, a major in the Air Force gets almost $200,000 a year. Is worshipped by the population. If he's deployed overseas, that money is put into a domestic account where 10%. Tax-free is added every year. These guys are well taken care of. And yet even with that, desertion rates are the highest they've ever been, possibly in history in America. Maybe the Civil War saw it even worse, but right now there is an estimated, depending on what sources you use, 60,000 cases of desertion in the U.S. military. I'm not talking about AWOL, I'm talking about desertion. The suicide rate is very high. Morale is very low. And you send this overstretched, exhausted force that hasn't fought regular soldiers, hasn't fought regulars since World War II. Not even Korea would count because they were often irregulars there. Now the Chinese, the exception of the 8th Red Army, the Chinese were, these were guerrilla fighters. These were still irregular forces. But they're green. They're really not used to having enemies that could fight back. And don't discount the fact that there is a strong ideological reason. Russia's come under attack for no clear reason. They've done nothing wrong in a moral sense. And yet these very, this overpaid American a military man is really out for himself. He gets his college paid for. He gets, he gets laid whenever he wants. This is how these guys, this is why they're there. No one ever dies for abstractions. As I've said many times before, No one dies for an abstract concept like trial by jury. So that difference is extremely important. That from a moral point of view, the American soldier can't stand up to the Russian. The Russian is very much aware of why he's fighting and why it's important. The American is not. The boys that might be coming home in bags will have no idea why they died. I think that's the case with the millions unnecessarily slaughtered in World War I, having no idea why they were there. The propaganda posters, you know, completely absurd. So still, I haven't answered my question. Why? Why this obsession? It proves without doubt that nationalism is the only enemy, not Bolshevism. The U.S. had, first of all, generally speaking, had no idea what Bolshevism was and didn't care. Bolshevism was never the problem. So the U.S. has been able to trade and function in every society. Putin is different because he is a nationalist and made that very clear. And he goes even further and he declares his adherence to Eurasianism. So he situates the Russian nation in this broader context. The bottom line is that the American dollar is cut out. It proves without question that the only enemy of the regime is nationalism. And therefore, the only weapon against the regime is nationalism. Well, I began by saying that Putin removed the bankers, the Western bankers, from dominating the country as they had under Yeltsin, and that is true. Liberalism, capitalism, liberal democracy was always going to be very unpopular in Russia because it's going to be associated with the complete meltdown of the Russian and Ukrainian economy in the 1990s to the point it's never been paralleled in history before. Putin paid off Russia's debt very early, by 2006, and he had even asked, I had an article on this a long time ago, he had asked to pay his debt off early. And they said no, which seems to be odd, especially for a bank that's always in crisis. But he paid his debt very early on. To be a civil servant in Russia, you may not own foreign securities. Recently, which is extremely important, the Russian anti-corruption law is the strictest in the world. It's very, very harsh. As some of you know, United Russia won last month in the legislative elections. It's about 63% of the popular vote that United Russia got. And given that Putin's popularity is between 60 and 70%, it makes sense. When the vote you get is roughly the same as your popularity, that's evidence that the election hasn't been rigged. Only American politicians have to rig elections. Only the Hillary Clintons or the JFKs have to rig elections. Putin absolutely does not. He's one of the most popular men in the world. Angela Merkel is at 40%. That's probably a very high estimate. The EU, as an institution throughout Europe, is 25-30% approval. Obama is about 40%. And Putin is usually between 70 and 80%. Lukashenko about the same. Americans hold politicians in contempt, hold lawyers in contempt. That's not the case in Russia. The two most trusted men in Russia, poll after poll after poll after poll, is Putin and Kirill. They do not see them as corrupt. They do not see them as rotten. They don't see them as perfect, but they see them as trustworthy. Putin created the infrastructure such that the Russian can rebuild his society and have the confidence to know that's not going to be taken from him tomorrow. He instituted a very low flat tax on all transactions. And one of the most important things that got the West livid at him was that any Russian media source could have no more than 20% foreign ownership. That sent them orbital, because propaganda is essential to this, you know, trying to overthrow the guy. Moscow Times and Petersburg Times, these are owned by the Washington Post. The Washington Post is deeply involved in Russian media and it controls them, like these companies usually do, not revealing itself. They want to act like this is a Russian publication when it's not. Keep in mind also, we talk about banks that Putin kicked out. The IMF and the World Bank are not really separate institutions. They're not separated from the elite banks that the regime depends on to function. They may have this cloak calling themselves that, but that's really all they are. Governments are not in charge here. Governments don't have a percentage where they vote. You know, these are the most powerful banks in the world that then instruct governments to do with theirs. So it's one mystification on top of another. Today, banks in the European Union are leveraged like 26 to 1. For every dollar in assets, there's 26 in debt. And that's being very generous. And probably the single most important reason is the process of de-dollarization. One of the primary ways that the U.S. has built its empire since World War II is by going to powerful oil-producing countries like the Gulf States, for example, promising them all kinds of support and aid and assistance so long as all transactions are done in dollars, which is certainly not, you know, certainly from their point of view is very easy to agree to. It means that there's always a demand for dollars, that any profits go into the U.S. Treasury. I mean, it's a Treasury bond debt in that case. The profits from these transactions are American and go right back to the Fed. For Russia to challenge this system, which they have, is to destroy the entire way of life that this General Mark Milley wants to protect. The oligarchy, the rule of finance capital. De-dollarization is the death of the empire. The empire is based around money and oligarchy and the dollar. And once that's not nearly in demand as much as it has been in this essential area, you know, fuel is essential to the modern economy, for better or for worse, the U.S. just becomes another country, unable to impose its so-called way of life on others. The liberal, individualist, feminist, abortion world that it demands the world follow. Recently, Russia has massively increased its gold holdings. China has done the same. Just a few years ago, it's, you know, Russia's holdings 30 million troy ounces. And this is the same for all the BRICS states. Now, the sanctions that were put on Russia several years ago, without clear reason, I think had something to do with the non-existent invasion of Ukraine. Something like that. The sanctions that were put on Russia were a very positive thing. And one of the most positive things that came out of it is that Putin was able to slowly but surely nationalize the central bank and getting rid of the Rothschilds who ran it. About a third of the central bank's employees and leadership was purged over the last few years. And now with the victory of United Russia in the parliamentary elections, there's a tremendous extraordinary mandate to continue this process. And this goes in every area, not just in finance, but in every area. Russia has compensated for the fact that Visa and MasterCard aren't used there due to the sanctions, for example, so that they have their own credit system. They've been forced to create their own institutions rather than rely on foreign ones. So the sanctions haven't hurt Russia in the least. It has hurt the European Union, but has been a net gain for Russia in every respect. And more recently, last year, Putin has engaged in a substantial purge of the bureaucracy in all areas, making sure that no liberal remains, that no holdover from the Yeltsin era can exist. Putin has made it very clear, and he said this over and over again, that the early Bolshevik Revolution was a Jewish ethnic movement. His hostility to Israel is well known. The very fact that he finances Hamas and that he continues to assist Assad in Syria is proof of this. Netanyahu goes to Russia as a suppliant. He comes to America as a dominating personality. He has placed the Russian Orthodox Church in its rightful position as a foundation of morals in the society. There would be no Russia without the church. There is no culture without the Orthodox Church. Most importantly, from a secular point of view, it stands for the maintenance of the strong family. And there can be no society worthy of the name that doesn't have a strong family structure behind it, or that it's based upon. In America, for example, families that have intact families are very rarely poor. Their poverty rate is like 7%, where broken families is much, much higher. And single mothers have a poverty rate of something like 60%. Crime is always reduced. Strong families, sons and daughters brought up with a mother and father, are not criminals. These are almost always the result of broken homes. Homosexuality comes from the lack of the father figure at home. The killing of the king, absolutely essential to liberalism. I've mentioned on this program many times, and some years ago, I went to great length to talk about the symbolism of the death of the king, which Freud made such a big deal about. Civilization as discontents. The killing of the king, the killing of the father, the killing of the center, the killing of unity. You kill the patriarch, and the sons and daughters can then go wild and do whatever they want, and usually dissipate the riches that the father had put together over a long period of time. Of the 200 wealthiest people in Russia, 25% are Jews. They are the oligarchs. They are 0.1% of the population. One thing that I did not predict this, I did not see this coming, but his intervention in Syria was a stroke of brilliance. This got the regime enraged at him. He exposed the fact that the U.S. created and is ISIS, ridiculous Hollywood name, and forced the U.S. to condemn Russian attacks on there. And by now, October 2016, much of their ammunition supply depots have been destroyed. And the howls of contempt from John McCain and the rest of it. The war on terrorism is a complete fraud. The U.S. is now openly allied with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. To be allied with Al-Qaeda is to say that the 9/11 narrative is false. You can never be connected with a group that's said to be in charge of the 9/11 attacks. It's all unraveling. The president of the Philippines has destroyed the drug trade, condemned by the U.S. The war on drugs is as fake as the war on terrorism. He has taken this very large, high IQ country and brought it under Chinese protection, which is not only a brilliant move economically, but is very popular politically. Some of you know, beginning of the Syrian crisis, 2011, there were two pipeline ideas, one controlled by the U.S. via Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and one under Iranian protection. Assad went with the Iranian version because Syria and Iran have historically been very close due to the contempt that the two factions of the Ba'ath Party have had between Iraq and Syria. It was almost immediately after his rejection of the Saudi pipeline idea, the Arab pipeline, I think it was called, only right after that, these spontaneous demonstrations took place, spontaneous. If you remember, back then, pro-government demonstrations dwarfed the anti-government ones. Bashar al-Assad is extremely popular. He never wanted power. He was creating a first world society, as was Gaddafi, as was Saddam Hussein. These countries are on the cusp of creating a first world country, which is intolerable to Israel, and so they have to be destroyed. And it just doesn't matter what pretext. These swaggering airmen are bombing civilians, they don't, you know, for no reason. So it's a video game to them, I guess. No motivation, no real morale, no real purpose here. Most of them have to know that they're on the wrong side. They're fighting on the wrong side. And so I say that the desertion rate in the American military is indicative of what's going on. It shows great moral courage. So in brief, this is a showdown between nationalism and globalism, Christianity and materialism, the New World Order versus tradition, U.S. dominance versus multipolarity and diversity in the true legitimate sense of the term. And Putin is making this very clear. He is not being, he's not shy about making the dividing lines very clear, and neither is the U.S. The United States of America in these conflicts is the evil empire. They're the bad guys. They serve corporate capital and are willing to sacrifice millions of Americans if necessary to save a few dollars on pipeline transit costs. But given the fact that the U.S. can't win, I mean, it has to be some miracle, some demonic miracle that the U.S. could ever win. Why is this the gamble? I mean, I've said many times before, the Daily Traditionalist and other shows, I've said with Andrew Hitchcock and that this is the gamble of the last gamble of the system. The economy is failing miserably. The industrial base of America has been totally hollowed out. Wages are plummeting. The country is deeply divided. It's a matriarchy completely. That's the nature of the U.S. It's failing in every way. The only way it can be salvaged is through warfare. I said this before, but historically, to win a war, especially a major world war, is not just to be the victor and the conqueror, but to vindicate everything you stand for. Nationalism is the enemy because Hitler and his allies lost in World War II. So the world was conveniently divided up between liberalism on the one hand and Marxism on the other hand. This is about legitimacy. This is about the Washington Consensus. Liberal democracy is a preferred, in fact, required form of state because it's not really a state. It's a small bureaucracy with window dressing politicians who don't know much. They're easy to control. And this facilitates the penetration of capital into the country. And any discrimination, this is part of the IMF austerity programs always, that American capital has to be treated no differently than local capital, which means a big, huge corporation moving in has just as many rights as the tiny street vendor. So that's their version of equality. What Putin is promoting, you know, I have my book on Russian populists, the political thought of Vladimir Putin, where I spend a lot of time establishing the notion that he is a social nationalist. He believes in the social market, that both the good things in socialism and market capitalism, in order to function, have to exist in the context of a virtuous society. And that can only be gained through unity, through a world of shared meanings that the nation really is, that make interaction among actors much easier. There's a clear economic payoff to an increase in trust among people. The Jews in European history have had a tendency to be victorious in times of chaos. The Gentiles are at each other's throats and unsure of themselves, but they are fanatically cohesive. Putin is not averse to saying that as well. So the insane, the blood-curdling screams coming out of Washington, D.C., the threats from a military man in this case, for the first time, I don't think I've ever heard that since General Patton in the past. The U.S. elites, the regime is demanding war. They will demand conscription. They will kill or allow millions to be killed for their profits, for their regime. And to be honest, I have the opinion that ideology, ideas are more important, especially to the wealthy, those who are already established, than dollars and cents. There's a lot of evidence for this. You know, corporations who, you know, keep, like media companies who keep unpopular TV shows on the air because they're politically correct. That's happened before. Don't discount ideology, but it's a massive gamble. If the U.S. loses, and they will, liberalism will be completely discredited throughout the world. The U.S. will lose all of its authority. The economy would go into a tailspin. The dollar would be rejected as the main global currency. So you would be humiliated. Look at Russia, war on Russia. Her main allies would be India, China, of course, Belarus, Kazakhstan, all the SCO states, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Iran, Armenia, small but very significant, North Korea, Singapore, even in Africa, Nigeria, Algeria, Guinea, South Africa, Latin America, Cuba, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, of course, the whole BRICS apparatus. Russia would not be in this war alone. I firmly believe the pro-American governments would be overthrown everywhere. North Korea will be let off its leash, for better or for worse. The U.S. will have no ally, because no one's going to die for the profits of a handful of oligarchs. And to this day, I can't comprehend the anti-Putin mentality amongst nationalists and rightists. What does this man have to do to satisfy them? I've read just recently, just, you know, 5-6 times, websites, journals saying that he's a pawn in the New World Order. He's performing his role. In other words, even his successes in fighting the New World Order is proof he's a part of the New World Order. They mangle the concept of dialectics, which is not what dialectics means. They believe that he is kind of the no to the yes of the New World Order. That's not how it works. That's not what dialectics is. You know, they're trying to sound scholarly there, but so even when he succeeds, he fails in their eyes. There's no way that he can satisfy them. And it's a curious phenomenon. Partly, I think it's because our people are so used to failure and misery that they can't believe that something good is happening. I think it's partly to do with a deep seated anti-Russian Slavic bias in the Anglo-American world and the German world. I think it's due to a great extent to ignorance of Russia and Russian history and political tradition. The West is a miserable failure in every respect. Economics doesn't even need, I don't even need to explain that. You know, we're at a point right now where the median American income is just over $30,000. Unemployment, the real unemployment rate is close to 30%. There is so much debt that there's no way the U.S. can recover. And socially, with feminism and abortion, homosexuality, there is simply, the West offers the world nothing but destruction. But corporate profits require, in the free market, they require the creation of the isolated individual, the ego, the bundle of passions. That's all it is. It has no real right to exist. It can come and go, just a bundle of nerve ending and nothing more. That's what's necessary in order to create the system that these people profit from. I'm not sure what Putin has to do. I've been in debates with anti-Putin right-wingers who say, you know, I mentioned all the oligarchs that he sent to jail, and they'll mention, well, he didn't do it to Potanin. So he's a phony. He didn't jail all of them. Or that he only gave, you know, $10 million to Hamas rather than 20. It's completely irrational. There's something else that's behind their rejection of him. I fully understand that the old KGB connection, it certainly has a lot to do with it, but that's not relevant anymore. Your best patriots in the USSR went to the security services. He had been a Christian his whole life, as he stated and as he's shown to the world just recently. He did not accept the Soviet system. He saw its demise as a total catastrophe, which it was. The total destruction, the complete liquidation of the economy, 80% of the economy liquidated and sent overseas. That was a catastrophe. Solzhenitsyn said the same thing. In 2000, Solzhenitsyn came close to saying that this is worse. At least the Soviets weren't saying that they're the epitome of freedom and democracy. But Putin rejected the liberal model, not just economically, but socially. And he took a third world backwater and made it into a dominant first world state in just a few years. It is a complete myth that Russia economically is dependent on oil and gas. At the most, it really depends on what kind of accounting technique you use to figure. The maximum is that all forms of oil, gas, and everything that's complementary to that is 16% of GDP at the most. And yet, if you search for it online, you'll see 80%. They're throwing out numbers. You know, Johnson's Law there is at work because, you know, not a whole lot of people know. Norway is far more dependent on oil and gas exports than Russia is for its economy. That Russian economic growth and recovery has not been connected necessarily with the prices of oil and gas. It's a great strategic resource, but is not the overwhelming dominant element in Russian life that the people say it is. It's about 15% of GDP, although it does comprise a substantial amount of exports. But that's to be understood. The Russian economy is extremely diverse. I think ultimately, if you were to put my feet to the fire, the reason that the U.S. elite are threatening to kill Russians and kill Americans in the process, primarily, is de-dollarization. That's the main issue, that the U.S. empire could fall without the domination of the dollar. Beyond that, though, I believe it has more to do with the projections of Westerners and their own failures, which they impose on Russians. The introduction of my Putin book has that as its main thesis. that they've constructed the Russian enemy. But after that, I would say it is ideological. American elites can't handle the fact that their ideology is false and is based on self-interest, not truth. And this is what's going to go down. If Trump is elected, chances are that it won't happen, but if Hillary is fixed and installed in office, she's already said she's going to do this. Americans need to be far more panicked than they are. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.